The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Glittering like a bejeweled, fabulous royal crown, another beautiful automobile is unveiled. And by the tens and the hundreds of thousands, Americans go to huge automobile shows or stand transfixed looking in the windows of display counters and cases where they see the imported foreign models, the latest in the bizarre designs of hood and grille and fender. From the Model A's and their rumble seats to the modern sports models built to look like Indy 500 racers, the saga of the American car has been a continual yardstick of the social structure of status and class consciousness, measuring of success, of the empirical self, and even of individual expressions of personality. Perhaps there is nothing quite so important to the American people as their own automobile, or the one they dream about, or perhaps we should say, lust about. And it's something you can fondle, you can caress it, you can care for it, you can look at it, you can admire it. One of the best feelings that we have sometimes is after a sunny, summery Sunday afternoon, out there shining and polishing away and just sort of fussing over the automobile. Why, you know, you do a lot better job at home and you enjoy it a lot more than taking the automobile down to the car wash, because at home you can get a chance to even get that fingernail in there in the last little crack of the chrome and really get that thing clean. And oh, do we feel good after that is over. How well you remember your first automobile. It's the first important toy for many of an American, and as a matter of fact, it never ceases to be an important item. You ever notice how in the TV quiz shows they can show the participants a whole range of fabulous presents they might be able to get, from carpeting, furs, furniture, a yearly supply of ham or bacon, and they will oh and ah a little bit mildly, but when they draw back that drape and show them an automobile, and it can be a little economy model, a very cheap one, and suddenly they just clasp their hands over their face and they let out a little squeal of sheer delight. There is nothing that is greater for us to imagine as a gift than an automobile. They can show them trips or rings or jewelry, stereo sets, a piano, but nothing really gets them excited, almost mesmerized, like an automobile. The automobile has totally altered our way of life. The entire character and the social structure of a nation has been changed as a result of the internal combustion engine, a nation on wheels equipped with more than half of the automobiles of all of the world, a nation on the move, a nation dedicated to the motor vehicle, working to own one or to share one with a bank, and one in five of us working to support one. That is a vast industry that means one-fifth of all the labor force directly or indirectly involved in motor vehicle manufacture, in maintenance, in all the services that go to support a motor vehicle-oriented society. The vehicles that we drive in, that we have seen around our streets and highways since the late 20s, the early 30s, in more and more millions of numbers, have completely changed everything in our society and our social structure. They have changed our countryside, gobbling up millions upon millions of acres for asphalt and concrete. They have changed the entire structure of our big cities, our inner urban dwellings, where we have to have high-rise apartments and high-rise garages side by side. They have changed not only the appearance of our cities, but they've changed the noise levels of our cities, and they have also sullied and soiled the air of our cities and of our countryside alike. They have changed the crime patterns, because many times automobiles figure importantly in crime, and it's estimated that one out of four of them have a concealed weapon inside. They changed the marriage picture in the United States and many other an industrialized country with a kind of a mesmerization or a love affair over the automobile. They've changed patterns of courtship and of dating, and therefore changed the marriage picture. They've changed the entirety of the surface of the earth, the quality of our air, and they have killed, in the last decade, about 550,000 Americans. Usually, 550,000 in a decade would be a shocking statistic, but not to us who are used to 55,000 a year. Maybe that will go down a little bit with lowered speed limits and perhaps people driving smaller cars a little more cautiously, but in many ways the automobile has changed us. Now the automobile, because of the fuel to be able to drive them, costs a great deal more money, seems about to betray us.
It was our first important toy. It is something almost like an idol. Well, you know, this preoccupation in the automobile and the internal combustion engine has given rise to a lot of psychological aspects of the motor vehicle addiction in the United States, some of it quite interesting. I believe this article appeared in Harper's Magazine. I believe, however, it was quoted from another magazine. The managing editor was Lewis Lapham, and he is quoted in the magazine as saying, even if we concede the wastefulness and stupidity of the car, I doubt that we would be willing to forswear its immaculate divinity. So he begins to see a bizarre idol in the automobile, sees it as something that America would not be willing to give up. He says, we have come to acknowledge it as a sublime image of the mystery that we but inarticulately express in the meager words for youth, beauty, power, spring, happiness, freedom, and desire. You know, when you look at Madison Advertising, they don't really sell an automobile to you. What they try to sell you is a desire. They sell you a lust, as it were. When you see an automobile advertised, you almost never see all of the many mechanical devices that go into it, the entire frame and the chassis and the exact gauge of the measurement of the thickness of the steel, if any, in the fenders and so on, the safety devices and all of this. But you see it from every angle of cameras, which elongates it. We want them to be wider and lower, until finally they're so low that they're down about 3 inches and we're lying taped to the thing flat on our backs and we can't even stretch out. As a matter of fact, many automobiles today are so poorly designed along the lines of being attractive to youth and attractive from a continual style changing, but so poorly designed that they are virtually hazardous to get in and out of. Many an older person has great difficulty in getting in or out of an automobile anymore. And, of course, some of the two-doors are all but impossible, especially for people with back troubles, which includes a fair segment of the American population. I think we remember the swept-back glass windows, many of the two-doors, and so many people have been, you know, had their throats nearly cut, or their eye nearly put out, or at least a sort of a bruise or a wound of some sort inflicted upon them because they'll swing the door shut just as somebody is getting in the back seat or something like this. They don't see it. And continually, it has been a rather insane repetition of the changing styles ever since the swept-back fins of the 50s that Nikita Khrushchev commented about when he told Richard Nixon in the famous kitchen scene that Americans build beautiful fins on their automobiles, but Russians build better missiles. So this one author was speculating about the erotic aspect of automobiles. He said, as the American sensibility subsides into decadence, the identification with the aesthetic becomes more attractive than the identification with courage or with physical strength. The automobile becomes an extension of ourselves. We'll show you that a little bit later on. He also said, the automobile offers the illusion of transcendence in the dimension of space. While driving at high speeds on a highway at night, a man can imagine that he holds his destiny in his own hands. His defiance of death persuades him to believe in his own immortality. Maybe there's something to that. You can say, well, that's his opinion. It's pretty far out. I might agree with you in part. But on the other hand, there is quite a psychological aspect to the American automobile that we ought to take a look at. And believe it or not, there is even a Bible scripture that talks about the fact that Americans worship the things that their own hands manufacture. As a matter of fact, in the second chapter of Isaiah and verse 7, it talked about a land filled with silver and gold and with goodies, no end to their treasures. Their land is filled with horses, neither is there any end of their chariots. An ancient archaic scripture talking about horse-drawn vehicles, to be sure, but notice it also says their land also is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made. I believe the American romance, if you want to call it that, or love affair with the automobile is possibly drawing to a close. But it's been quite a romance while it lasted.
What's behind the energy crisis? In 1850, the United States used wood for over 90% of its energy needs. By 1920, it used mostly coal. But in 1971, oil and gas accounted for over 76% of its power. Changing patterns of society in America, Canada, Australia, and other countries have seen changing patterns in energy consumption. Each week's U.S. oil consumption equals a line of 10,000-gallon freight cars stretching from Darwin to Melbourne and back. But how much oil is there left in the world? And how will it be distributed? What's behind the energy crisis is an Ambassador College publication designed to give you an overall view of the problem, its history, and how it will affect you in the future. Request your free copy of the booklet, What's Behind the Energy Crisis? There's no charge or obligation. Request and read, What's Behind the Energy Crisis? For your free copy, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales, 2001.
They're still manufacturing automobiles, and people are still thinking about buying automobiles, but the question is, what kind? And will we learn the lesson as a result of the fantastic switch of so many thousands of American buyers to the smaller, more economical models that will give them more mileage to change styling into some rational design? The answer, no. You can go back and think of changing styles over the past decades and speculate, perhaps for the moment, that Detroit could have learned the lesson from Volkswagen perhaps 20 years ago or more. They could have learned the lesson from Rolls-Royce of yesteryear in Britain that you do not necessarily need to continue to bend the tin around into all sorts of bizarre shapes, to put fake air scoops all over the automobile which serve no useful purpose, to stretch the grill out many inches in front of the actual assembly of the automobile itself or the radiator, to do all kinds of things with the back end, the front end, the side, little lines and indentations, which after all causes a tremendous expenditure and overhead in terms of tooling up for all of this design and style change, and you can still sell automobiles. In the first place, it should have been obvious to anybody in Detroit in the style aspect of automobiles that Americans were addicted to the motor vehicle, that we would have bought whatever was available. But as long as the dollar is the incentive, and as long as people are scrambling over one another to produce a more attractive automobile, and as long as it was the youth or the person that was, without realizing it, seeing in himself an extension of himself and his own personality, an expression of the way he feels he wants to be or the way he wants to appear, and there was even a certain sexist symbol, the young fellow with a convertible and the like, the fellow with a lecherous sneer and the racy sports model. So Detroit continued on the style binge and will continue in the same way. So will automobiles be more practical? Will it be easier to get in and out of? Will they give you a lot more mileage? Will they be far safer? Will they be everything that they really ought to be? The answer is probably no. The Detroit system still reigns supreme, and they're free to pursue the dream car lines and youth appeal, no matter how detrimental the results might be. It's true that certain decision-making powers over what future cars will be like have been removed from Detroit by Washington, D.C., especially along the lines of, well, you've heard the speculation about airbags and the like. We now know about the obnoxious buzzers, three or four different tones for three or four different things, all the way from the brake to the belts, which, of course, they just keep on buzzing all the time, to any number of things, including the door open or the key still in the lock. But, you know, beyond that, Detroit has not really been controlled, and so the size and the shape of the car is still left entirely up to the designer's decision. Most United States cars have disproportionate amounts of front overhang. 45 inches from the front wheel hub to the bumper face is commonplace, and while automobile companies may pretend that this is necessary to provide a desired impact so that it can kind of crumble slowly and at a certain gradual rate and minimize the deformation of the passenger compartment, that's not necessarily true, and it's been demonstrated by Mercedes-Benz, for example, that a lot of front overhang is not at all essential to ensure good crash characteristics. If you look under the hood of some cars, you find 10 to 12 inches of empty space between the radiator and the grill. And the reason for that is that, for some reason, an automobile is supposed to look better and more attractive if it's longer. Now, I thought that maybe they're going to come to the place that they would hinge automobiles in the middle, so that as you would go around corners, you could even have two steering wheels. You could put your kid in back, and just like some of the old hook and ladder trucks you used to see, our cars would get so long, finally, a family car, maybe a diner in the middle, could be a three-part car, something like that, and the kid back in the back could be driving the back end of it. He could be doing a mambo, you know, down the street. But they didn't quite get that long, only in cartoons, but we weren't worried about it there for a while. When bumper standards were first introduced, the industry's first worry was how new bumpers could be made to look good. because bumpers aren't supposed just to be bumpers like they used to be back in the old Model A's and the like, with just spring steel out there. And if you bump somebody, that's all that happened. You bumped him and you bounced back a little, the spring steel gave, and it might have jarred your teeth loose or something, but really not much damage at fairly slow speeds. Today, in a 5-mile-an-hour collision between a bicycle and an automobile, the bicycle usually wins. There was a case, I think, where a child backpedaling in his tricycle ran into his daddy's car, and I think it was something like $300 damage to the automobile, that is. I'm just kidding, of course. So wherever you look, it seems like stylists are a kind of a crazy bunch of people. They have no real sense of values. They can come up with a design where one year it seems to be sensible, makes some sense. I can go back to a car I own, and can't we all, to talk about things of the past. This happened to be a Dodge station wagon years and years ago. They had, of all things, the idea that they could take the spare tire space that was in under the deck lid at the back, and they could give you some extra baggage space there, and put the spare tire out underneath that right fender. You may remember that model. I forget the exact year. To get at it, you could leave the back end packed. And if you were driving along in Cheyenne, Wyoming, or somewhere in the middle of a blizzard, and you had a flat tire, which happened to me one time just outside Cheyenne, except it wasn't in my Dodge, believe me, you could get outside, you could leave the babies, everybody in there nice and snug and warm, get outside and get the tire. But no, the very next year they changed it back again. So instead of leaving it out there where it belongs, and where earlier automobiles always had it, they had it back to the trunk, or they had it up on the fender. And don't those things look great?
Don't they look beautiful? And wouldn't most people just dearly love
to own one of the classics? You know, one of the old Mercedes or a Bugatti or something like that of way back in the 20s or 30s with those spare tires right on the running board.
They look so jazzy. They look so sexy. When you go to an automobile show,
usually you have to go to a museum to see that kind of a car. You can't help but wonder, why don't they build them that way today? But they don't. But in this one year, they also had the mirror, the rear-view mirror, up on the top. The very next year, they put it right in the middle. You remember some of the automobiles where they actually punched a hole in the glass and they put the rear-view mirror right in the middle? That was so beautiful for the middle passenger in the front seat. You could try to look out, but you couldn't, because right in your way was the rear-view mirror cocked at an angle. And so what you got to see was a combination of what was coming at you and what was going by. And it just made your head swim. I know that time and time again, my wife would comment that she was getting sick from riding over in the middle of this particular Dodge that we had. So not being satisfied with leaving it where it ought to be, and of course the outside mirror is the most practical of all, they kept changing even the location of that around year after year after year. So they changed the fins, the bumpers, the hood, the grills, whether or not the side of it looks this way or that, and has nothing whatsoever to do with the performance of the car, really nothing basically to do with the cost, except as they wish to get a low profile, long hood, sporty roof line, whatever that means. And now they're even doing funny things with the rear end of these automobiles, which looks almost suggestive, and trying to make them look like an Indy 500 racer, which I think is supposed to smack of aerodynamic design. So presumably here you are going at a maximum of 55 miles an hour with this huge engine up there at almost idle, hopefully conserving gasoline, but your idea in your mind is that you're flying a jet airplane and you're going at such speed that if you were just pulled back a little bit, you'd lift off. So you have to have this aerodynamic design in the back end, which forces the automobile down onto the pavement and doesn't allow it to take off. It seems a little bit silly, but no matter what the problems in the automotive industry, there's one thing they won't give up on very quickly, and that is design. Well, with the tremendous plethora of articles about the psychology of automobiles, there was one man that speculated that the automobile is the last stronghold of solitude in the American way of living, that the automobile, not the home, is now a man's castle. It's the only place where a person can get away all by himself. I'll come right back and we'll discuss the last remaining place outside of the bathroom where an American can truly be alone.
For 40 years, the Plain Truth magazine has been supplying the missing dimension in education. The Plain Truth is published monthly as a facet of Ambassador College's In the Home Educational Service. It maintains an editorial policy that incorporates this missing dimension in education, biblical understanding. The Plain Truth, timely, informative articles, deal with subjects covering success in business, recreation, politics, religion, farming. Each issue not only documents the state of today's society, but offers hope for a better world tomorrow. To serve its more than 6 million readers, The Plain Truth is published in 5 languages and is available without price or obligation to all who request it. Join the growing worldwide readership. Request your subscription to the magazine with a 40-year history of educational service to mankind. The Plain Truth. Send your request to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales, 2001.
The idea that the automobile is a man's last bastion of privacy is not necessarily a wrong idea. How many times have you known friends of yours, or how many times have you done it yourself, who, when they're having some kind of a family battle, or the kid is teed off with the parents and just wants to get out of the house, the first thing they think of is, I'll just go for a drive. The front door slams, and you hear a motor roar, and a car pulls out of the driveway. It's a place where people can't knock and tell you to hurry up, which they can do in the bathroom. And, of course, most automobiles are equipped with a lot of personal paraphernalia. Everything from little dancing, hanging monkeys, or a pair of baby shoes, to religious items on the dashboard, to various slogans and so on, stamps and match covers, on down to very dramatic and powerful stereos and tape decks where people can have their own entertainment center right in the automobile. A father of 5 in his late 30s went so far as to explain how his van, in driving to and from work because it was quite large and airy, was the only time he really felt free to rage and to spit and rant and rave, and he called it his private therapy van because he could get in there, roll up the windows, and just yell at society. And it was especially an outlet for him to get involved in a big freeway traffic jam and just sit there and grip the wheel and just, just screaming and yelling at what was going on around him. Well, you know, the quest for privacy has a great deal to do with the car population boom, in one reporter's opinion, and also the fact that most automobiles, you see, over half of them are occupied by only one person. It's a truism that cars are so popular because they're individualized. There might be 300 automobiles of the exact make and model and everything else you want, but they're not the exact color, they don't have the exact accessory package, and just the way you dreamed of it in your mind, you'll wait, you'll order it, you'll go even maybe look at a different model to try to get a different automobile. Nothing can compare with an automobile for getting you yourself, all by yourself, from point A to point B, when you wish to go, by the route you wish to take, without having to put up with other human beings around. You can be all by yourself, turn on the stereo or the FM set, and this, in many people's opinion, has a great deal to do with the automobile population explosion. It's like the second TV set, because after all, one automobile is not necessarily the expression of the personality of all the members of the family. And it's the last place, as this writer puts it, where anybody can really be alone. As a futurist, Don Fabin, put it, kind of interesting, the reason the average passenger car carries only 1.5 passengers is because 0.5 passengers can't talk back. That's true. Inside the car and the bathroom are the only last places that a person has a chance of really being left alone. And they have determined now, by watching people driving along in their cars, that nose-picking is the runaway first choice for all in-car entertainment and the most common activity on the freeway after driving. But mostly, the automobile is an extension of ourselves, an expression of our own personality. The way we feel about our role in life is expressed by the kind of a car we drive. And I think the old Bill Cosby record about the custom-built racing car with his scarf starched straight back and his white kid racing shoes, and the one that had the pipes coming out all over, is a fantastic example of that. You see a few examples of different types of personality here. For a while there, in the mid-60s, it seemed like half the long-haired young kids in the entirety of the United States had a Volkswagen van with love painted on the sides and curtains so you couldn't see what was going on inside. Not that anyone necessarily wanted to. But, of course, polishing the thing and fondling it and mooning over it and looking at it and getting the ohs and ahs of neighbors as you come home with a new one has always been a great American institution. I remember so very well the first automobile my brother and I ever went in on. It was a 1934 Ford, and we thought that was the most beautiful automobile we'd ever seen. To make it look racy, we even took the fenders off of it. We kind of rebuilt it and tinkered with the engine, put in a new transmission, and we really would rattle off the things like, Offenhauser engines and high compression heads and a chop cam and three-quarter stroke cam and chop flywheel, rather, and all that type of thing. In those days, we thought, you know, hot rods and cut down, stripped automobiles were so exciting to us. But you know, I've thought so many times as we see this fantastic, never-ending stream of design change and of these gas-gulping, huge engines that make a lot of noise and still have to go only about 55 miles an hour, now with the lowered speed limits at least, I've wondered what it would be like if somebody could get hold of a factory somewhere where he could tool up to produce a Model T. You know, he couldn't do it exactly, I imagine. Ford would have to do that. They probably have all the rights on it. But wouldn't it be interesting to be able to have an automobile that would get you about 22, 23, 25 miles per gallon, that would go along at a comfortable speed of 35 or 40, that had a pedal for reverse, and that had instruments that modern automobiles do not have, including a spark, which has to do with the timing mechanism, of course, and a mixture control so you can lean out the amount of gas consumption. I would think that even though today they are beginning now to put a few more items in an automobile for fuel conservation measures, they are not going so far as to putting in manual choke and manual throttle controls, a mixture control, or a timing control, so that as you drove into higher elevations, you could begin to lean out the mixture of that automobile, it would run far greater. Now, they are beginning to put in overdrive, so you can get down into a higher gear, and I think they're beginning to change somewhat the gear ratio and the power delivered to the rear end and the axle, but they should have done that a long time ago, because all that power just for pickup or initial thrust is a waste of power, and of course 50% of the energy we use in all areas is wasted anyhow. So maybe, just maybe, sooner or later, Detroit is going to get the message. They could have gotten it with the very first arrival, the very first Volkswagen. It was way back, I believe, in the 1950s that Lord Beaverbrook's Daily Express in England said that the Volkswagen is going to do to us what Hitler's submarines failed to do in World War II. Well, now maybe it's true that already by this time the Volkswagen has done it to Britain. And maybe, along with the Toyota, the Suzuki, the Subaru, the Honda, and so many other products of Japan and West Germany, the same comment could be made of the United States of America. It seems that hindsight is so beautiful. Maybe we will grow up in our attitude toward the automobile. Maybe we will come to see that we have had a love affair with the automobile which has been near idolatry, and will realize it has been very, very bad for us in every conceivable aspect of our daily way of living. Maybe, I say, but the likelihood of that is rather remote. You ought to write for the current number of the Plain Truth magazine and also get this current booklet called What's Behind the Energy Crisis. This booklet really puts you in the picture, shows you how we were forewarned months and even years in advance, and shows you where we go from here. If you want to find out whether or not we were forewarned and what is the global overview, then you need your copy, What's Behind the Energy Crisis. It's free of charge. You can read it in one sitting. It's about the size of a Reader's Digest, but about a third that thickness or less. It's in-depth, statistically, absolutely documented from many authoritative sources. It takes you behind the scenes to show you how it all began, what really happened in the wake of the Yom Kippur War, what the prices are, what the future looks like, where we go from here in this booklet, What's Behind the Energy Crisis. And while you're at it, be sure to write to the current number of The Plain Truth, read by people all over the world, centered on at least three continents simultaneously. We'll send you your free copy, coming out now in tabloid newsprint, coming out twice a month, twice as often, with twice the impact and twice the number of articles as before when we had the slick magazine. We've had to fight inflation too, and one way to do it has been reduce the cost of The Plain Truth, yet we found a way to do that and yet increase its impact and increase the number of articles.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.